Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, as we wait for the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, some advocates worry about the mental health consequences of not having an abortion exception for survivors of rape and incest. We'll find out why. Now, the modern pinball machine was invented way back in the 1930s, and the game stuck around, made its way into bars, restaurants, basements, and it still has a lot of fans, including our next guest. Ian Jacoby is founder and editor-in-chief of Nudge Magazine, where he writes about pinball under the name Doc Monday. He returned to his old stomping grounds at Volume 1 in Eau Claire for a look at pinball here in Wisconsin. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
When did you discover your love of pinball?
Boy, everyone kind of has this story. For me, I think it was in 2016 maybe, but whenever Game of Thrones pinball came out, it was at like a, yeah, this, boy, I can I say bar on like WPR?
Sure.
It feels so weird.
You can
weird.
Say bar.
Yeah, this is Wisconsin. You know, I was in a bar. I mean, and so, yeah, they had Game of Thrones pinball, and I was just playing it with my buddy Josh and got kind of just obsessed with it. And then eventually moved to Minneapolis, and I lived about two blocks from one of the greatest pinball places in the country called Tilt. And, yeah, from there, it was just I was hooked.
I've always enjoyed pinball. I've never been hardcore at it. I'm also terrible at it. What makes the difference between somebody who's good at pinball and somebody who's, say, me?
Honestly, I think just practice and maybe a little bit of attitude. I think you have it in you. I mean, we've just met, but yeah, I think you just you practice a lot. It's just something for me. It was like I used to shoot free throws a lot, you know, just by myself, and it was something that it was like I can just zone in on this one task, you know. I don't have to think about anything else going on in my life. I can kind of just hit this ramp over and over again, and it's really satisfying. And so I think people who are really good at it, it's just kind of taken hold of them, and they practice a lot. So like anything else, I think that's what separates them.
All right, two words that come up. Nudge, the name of your pinball magazine, like you nudge the machine. You mentioned a place called Tilt, which is what happens when you nudge the machine too far. So when I've tried to do this, either I do something so minimal that it doesn't affect the motion of the ball at all, or I go too far and I tilt. Can you really control the ball by nudging the pinball machine?
Yes, you can. So what I'm going to say right now is I think even in those micro nudges, which is what I've heard them called, I know, what a term, right? But those do actually affect the ball, but I hear what you're saying. It's probably going out the out lane, so maybe that's what I would encourage you to nudge a little sooner. And so, like, for us, nudge, right, it means to – it's sort of there's a lot of meanings to nudge, right? We're sort of trying to agitate a little bit, but also, you know, you nudge someone when you know them. There's a lot of different kind of meanings to it, and I think that's kind of you never want to treat a pinball table poorly, but you know, it is ultimately you against the machine. So I always tell people, I'm like, don't be afraid to give back a little bit. So
in your piece in Volume 1, you highlight some great places to play pinball in the Eau Claire area and some beyond in the state. What are great hot spots here in Wisconsin? Hit us with a couple.
Oh, boy. Well, one of the best in the country is this place called District 82, and it's located just outside Green Bay. They have 100 machines there, and it's kind of an all-you-can-play place, so you don't have to worry about bringing a ton of quarters. And they actually are heavily involved in IFPA, which is that's competitive pinball. So they will do all kinds of big tournaments there, but also they just have it open to the general public, and I think that's a really good place. Like, either if you have a specific game that you want to play and you just can't find it anywhere, they almost definitely have it. Or if you're just kind of looking to hang out and survey like what's going on in pinball now, that's also good. But so definitely District 82. I know there's a place in Menominee Falls called Garcade, and they have a great amount of pinball machines. But honestly, I would just encourage you, there's a website called Pinball Maps. They don't pay us or anything, but if you go on there, it will show any pinball machines that are located around you. And like, there are nerds like me who go in there and they will update it regularly. So, you know exactly what game is in there and like what condition it's in.
All right. I'm going to age myself here. I went into pinball on the Evel Knievel machine.
Oh, nice.
And then at an older age, my favorite was Pinbot. I would play either of those now if you put them in front of me. What, Ian, is you mentioned Game of Thrones brought you in. What if I said you got to play a machine right now, what would be your go-to?
So there is one king of pinball right now, and it's Godzilla. It came out last year. It was created by this guy, Keith Elwin, who basically, the way I try to explain to people is Keith Elwin is like the Michael Jordan of pinball. Like, he wins every tournament. He's been number one for like 20 years. And then he was hired by the best company or biggest company, Stern Pinball, to design tables for him. And so Godzilla is just, it's so cool. It's got like all kinds of different, you know, you're fighting monsters in it, but the flow of it is really good. It's an exciting game. It's good if you're like a beginner. You can do a lot of different things on it, but also if you get kind of more advanced, the code of the game is very, very deep. So that's by far, like, when you go on all the websites, that's the one that like everyone is raving about right now.
And Ian, if somebody's out there thinking, yeah, I want to get into pinball or get back into pinball, give them a little advice for their first couple rounds.
Well, first of all, I'll say this as general life advice, be kind to yourself, right? Like, you're going out there and you're doing something, and that's good. That's kind of what I like about pinball. Whether you're good at it or bad at it, I don't think really matters. For me, it's kind of just being out there amongst people and playing. And pinball is really like a social activity. I think that's what sets it apart from video games or anything like that is, you know, you're going out somewhere. Most people don't own pinball machines because they're pretty expensive. So, you know, you're going to a bar or wherever, you know, restaurants. And yeah, that's kind of part of the fun. So I would say just people watch, have a favorite beverage, whatever that is. For me, often it's actually Diet Coke, so I can really just stay zoned in on what's going on. And then, you know, just have fun.
Ian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
That's Ian Jacoby, founder and editor-in-chief of Nudge Magazine. He wrote a recent piece for Volume 1 Magazine in Eau Claire about pinball, past, present, and future, and what's going on around Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin audience question about Rib Mountain.
There's a rumor that Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin is an extinct volcano. It seems somewhat reasonable. You can see it from miles away, and there are volcanic rocks all over the city of Wausau. Well, it's not. It never was. And although it does have ties to ancient volcanoes, the star of Rib Mountain's story is a rock too tough to break. Liz Domes Harder brings us the story.
You could say Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin has stood the test of time. I'm not talking about its ski hill that has been open since 1937, nor the state park that's been there for almost a century. I'm talking about something much older.
The rock that makes up Rib Mountain is called quartzite. It's a very, very hard rock, one of the hardest on Earth, and it's estimated to be about 1.7 billion years old.
That's Scott Spoolman, a science writer who lives in Madison and literally wrote the book on Wisconsin's rocks called, well, Wisconsin Rocks.
That's 1,700 million or 17 million centuries old.
So this stuff lasts. But where did it come from? Mark Janowiak from New Glarus has wondered a lot about that.
You know, I'm a Wikipedia expert on Rib Mountain, so I learned, three things about it.
Janowiak and I both grew up near Rib Mountain and spent plenty of winters skiing its slopes. He sent in a few questions to Wisconsin about Rib Mountain, and they got me curious, too.
Is Rib Mountain volcanic in origin? How big was the, if it is, how big is the, like, the volcanic range?
There were four volcanoes in the Wausau area 1.8 billion years ago, explains Lisa Seward. She's a senior lecturer of geography and geology at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. But Rib Mountain wasn't one of those volcanoes. It was the hard rock underneath one of them.
Underneath volcanoes are magma chambers, and those magma chambers brought up a bunch of this super-duper hard rock that we call quartzite.
Spoolman explains where that came from.
It's originally sandstone. It's ancient sandstone, and it was deposited by ancient seas, and then it was eventually buried under other sediments and then mashed by continental collisions that caused unimaginable heat and pressure and metamorphosed that sandstone into the very hard rock called quartzite.
We can get a sense of how big the volcano was. In the footprint of one of those old volcanoes are three quartzite blobs: Hardwood Hill, Mosinee Hill, and of course, Rib Mountain.
Think of the size of Rib Mountain. That is a quartzite blob.
Keith Montgomery has some good analogies. He's a retired geography and geology professor who lives in Wausau.
You can think that the mountains that existed here would have been similar to Mount Rainier or Mount Baker, those kinds of mountains. So several thousand feet, maybe 10,000 feet above the local terrain.
For comparison, Rib Mountain is 650 feet above the local terrain. The mountain range that stretched across the upper Midwest and into Canada quickly eroded away. Spoolman explains.
There were no plants or animals, so everything was eroding almost as fast as it was growing.
Still, weathering was no match for Rib Mountain's quartzite. But what about glaciers? Janowiak had a question about that, too.
Because one thing I read is the glaciers kind of went around. It didn't go over the top. Or did it go over the top?
There's been four major glaciations in the last million years or so. And pretty likely that three of those four did cross over Rib Mountain.
The most recent glacier stopped short of the mountain. The other three before it might have scraped off some chunks. Lucky for those of us who enjoy the mountain, that quartzite is one tough rock.
WPR's Liz Domes-Harder brought us that story on Rib Mountain. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin-based sexual assault survivor advocate who will walk us through some of the mental health concerns women considering an abortion may face after surviving rape or incest. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. A leaked draft of a U.S. Supreme Court opinion that would overturn Roe v. Wade is bringing up questions about different situations that women might face if they're seeking an abortion, including the idea of having abortion exceptions for survivors of rape and incest. According to an article from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, some pro-life advocates say that an abortion exception for rape and incest would only further perpetuate a cycle of violence. But the majority of the U.S. population has shown support of those exceptions. Kelly Molitke is the Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Kelly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, rape and incest is traumatic to begin with. Can you talk about some of the mental health concerns you have if abortion access is restricted to people who have already survived that?
Yeah, of course. The trauma of sexual assault impacts survivors in lots of different ways. Similarly, mental health issues are complex, and survivors respond differently and have different mental health needs afterwards. It's important to remember that through this trauma, right, survivors are not broken. They are surviving and thriving in ways that are best for them. And ultimately, they should be trusted and empowered to make important decisions about their physical and mental health. And when they are given those decisions, including making decisions about their body, it helps them to regain some of the control that they've lost after an assault.
Sometimes I think exceptions in cases of rape or incest are seen as a middle ground. But I know there are concerns that, okay, if you're looking to get an abortion using those exceptions, you then have to, prove that you are a survivor of rape or incest. Can you talk about how that might work on a practical level?
Yeah, that's where things get really, really tricky. And while we understand the inclination and in some ways like appreciate that there's a thoughtfulness around survivors in this discussion, these exceptions are not something that WCASA supports for a lot of reasons. And, you know, first of all, abortion access and choice are about the autonomy and authority a person has over their own body. And these concepts are also foundational to sexual violence prevention. Individuals need to have decision-making authority over their body, whether it's the choice to participate in sexual activity, to use birth control, or to terminate a pregnancy. And any restrictions to this autonomy, particularly state-sanctioned restrictions, sends the message that your body is not your own. And that brings us to, you know, it's also important to think about the implementation, which is the part you were getting to, and who gets to decide, how do they decide, what evidence is needed, right? And let's face it, proving sexual assault has rarely gone well for survivors, regardless of the system we're talking about. Oftentimes, these exceptions require a report to law enforcement, something we know the vast majority of survivors don't want to do. And furthermore, it puts an additional burden on marginalized communities who have been harmed by the very systems now charged with making this decision.
We are talking to Kelly Molitke, Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, looking at the potential end of Roe v. Wade and protections for people seeking abortions, the impact that could have, particularly on people who have survived rape or incest. Kelly, I mentioned that leaked Supreme Court document, an actual ruling. We don't know what it will be, but an actual ruling expected to come out probably in the next week and a half or so. Assuming it did overturn Roe v. Wade, this Wisconsin 1849 law would come into effect restricting abortion, except in some cases where there's a threat to the life of the mother. What are your concerns if that happens, that sequence of events happens, for the well-being, the mental well-being of the people you work with at the coalition?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about a little bit already about the impact, right? Like, how does this play out? There's not a system in place for this, and we don't want to create a new system that is to validate claims, you know, of rape in order to access abortion. And we also have to remember that with any bans or exceptions comes enforcement. And as states criminalize abortion, individuals will be investigated for their private medical decisions and are more likely to be criminalized for these decisions. And we know how criminalization works, right? We've seen it in many different ways. And the racial injustices of the criminal legal system are well documented. These laws will target and disproportionately impact people of color. They're going to target and harm survivors. We're very concerned about the implications of this Supreme Court decision.
Again, if this law takes effect, resumes effect here in Wisconsin after the potential end of Roe v. Wade, there wouldn't be that exception for rape or incest in Wisconsin. How are you planning when it comes to dealing with the mental and emotional needs that might create for the survivors you work with?
Yeah, survivors need, you know, actually survivors deserve the full range of decisions related to their medical concerns after an assault. And survivors often have a lot of medical concerns after a rape. And one thing we try to do is offer survivors ways to regain some of the control lost after that assault. And if abortion isn't one of those options, especially for a survivor who is pregnant, that's another loss of control and additional trauma that person's going to have to experience. And I ask folks to imagine this, right? Like, imagine you've just experienced, you know, a really traumatic event like a rape, and you're seeking ways to regain some sense of control, to navigate how to move forward. And then you find out in the midst of all of that trauma that you're pregnant and live in a state where abortion is illegal, which is what we're facing here in Wisconsin. And again, you find yourself completely out of control over what happens to your body. And this time by a state sanctioned law that you have even less control over. And I, you know, we're really, you know, we're trying to help advocates figure out how to support survivors through this, but we're struggling too. It's really hard to imagine, and it's going to be really difficult for survivors and advocates to navigate.
Before or after that ruling comes down, for someone who is a survivor, what resources would you point them toward to seek help? And here I'm not just talking about abortion, but to deal with all the issues that are coming from that.
Yeah, it's important for survivors to know that that we see you, we believe you, and there's lots of people out there to provide support. And that support exists in counties all across the state. People can go to WCASA's website, which is WCASA.org, and hit the Get Help button and find out what services are available. And advocates are available to support survivors with any decisions that they're facing. And help them process the trauma that they've experienced.
In just our last minute or so, what are you watching for? What are you getting ready for now over this, what could be the last week of Roe v. Wade?
gosh, again, we're just trying to engage with partners in the reproductive health world. We're talking to advocates to help prepare them for, the role of an advocate is to help survivors process decisions and to give them their options. And we're taking away a really big option for survivors. And so we want to help prepare advocates in having that conversation with survivors, as well as identifying how to eliminate barriers. That's another important role an advocate plays, is eliminating barriers. So it's going to be finding access in other places and helping them process this significant barrier that they now face.
Kelly, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for having this important conversation.
Kelly Mo Litke is the Associate Director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She was with us today to talk about possible mental health implications for survivors of rape or incest who would be looking for an abortion, specifically if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned, as seems very possible, a decision awaited from the U.S. Supreme Court, possibly this week or in the next week after that. And that would trigger a Wisconsin law from 1849, effectively banning all abortion except some circumstances to save the life of a mother. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the congressional panel investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol hold its next public hearing. Join the Ideas Network tomorrow afternoon at 2. We'll have live NPR coverage, the actual broadcast from the U.S. House Committee with analysis from NPR. That'll start at 2 here on Wisconsin Public Radio, or you could stream online with the Wisconsin Public Radio app or at WPR.org. Then, depending on how timing shakes out, we'll bring you some analysis of that, of tomorrow's testimony and hearings and witnesses. That'll come up tomorrow here on Central Time, again, depending on how long that goes. Watch for coverage of the January 6th Commission. That's tomorrow afternoon here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then a technology philosopher joins us for a look at the ethics and morals surrounding artificial intelligence after a Google engineer raised concerns about technology potentially becoming sentient. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a pediatrician answers your questions about the COVID vaccines for infants and kids under 5. First, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its fourth hearing yesterday. The group focused on how former President Trump pressured state and local officials to reject the results of the 2020 election and in some cases submit unofficial slates of pro-Trump electors in states that had been won by Joe Biden. One piece of new evidence yesterday involves Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Text messages show Johnson's staff asked the vice president's team on January 6th if he could hand over a list of alternate electors for Michigan and Wisconsin. Vice President Pence's staff refused. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's covered this and is here to get us caught up. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you remind us what these false slates of electors were and why we had one here in Wisconsin?
Well, this was part of a legal strategy at first by the Trump campaign. Some of the electors had said that the idea was, as court challenges, seeking, like in Wisconsin, to throw out certain amounts of absentee ballots or what have you, as those were working their way through the courts, the idea was that having these alternate electors would help, if the cases were won, then they would be, they could be submitted to Congress and potentially be chosen in lieu of the Democratic elector votes for Joe Biden. So this was in multiple swing states. Wisconsin was one of them. And that's essentially what I understand about the process.
The court cases didn't overturn those election results, but those documents signed by electors didn't go away, at least according to this exchange. Can you remind us what this exchange between a Senator Johnson staff or his chief of staff as of that day and the vice president staff? What did we learn in this exchange?
So there was a screenshot presented by the committee during the hearing, and it really jumped out at me. You know, I'm looking for a Wisconsin connection to all of this, knowing that we had these alternate electors or fake electors as the committee has described them. But essentially, Johnson's chief of staff, Chris Hodgson, reached out, I'm sorry, Senate Sean Riley, Johnson's chief of staff, reached out to Chris Hodgson, who's an aide for Mike Pence. And this was like right before the attack on the Capitol and right before the electors were going to be certified by Congress and by Pence. And Riley basically asked, he said, Johnson needs to hand something to V. POTUS. And when Hodgson asked what it was, Riley responded, alternate slate of electors from Michigan and Wisconsin, because archivists didn't receive them. The archivist that he's talking about is the, you know, the National Archives, which they were also sent to. And Pence's aide Hodgson told him, do not give that to him. So in, it makes it look like Senator Johnson was willing to hand those to Mike Pence, you know, right before the actual certification process was about to begin.
Johnson's office responded saying it's not a story, basically. Reporters talked to Senator Johnson outside the Capitol yesterday, asked him about it. Here's a listen to that exchange with Manu Raju of CNN.
This was a staff-to-staff exchange, and I was, you know, basically unaware of it. And the chief staff contacted the vice president's staff, said, do you want this? They said no, and we didn't deliver it, and that's the end of the story.
But why was he even asking for that?
Because somebody delivered this to our office and asked to deliver that to the vice president.
Did you support the, his efforts to try to get those slates to the vice president?
No, I had no knowledge of this.
So what questions are people still trying to resolve here, Rich, about this situation?
Well, there are still questions about whether Senator Johnson was involved with it or not, because the text seems to indicate that Johnson indicated he wanted to hand this to the vice president. So that's one question. There's a lot of questions about who, you know, dropped this manila envelope off at the senator's office. Some folks are implying that Johnson was involved with receiving them as well. Like he was knowledgeable. And then also there, some of the other testimony and documents that were revealed by the committee yesterday showed that the if people with Trump's campaign were asking some of these alternate electors in Wisconsin to fly this over, you know, on the January 4th, just a couple days before the certification was set to go down. And so there was a concerted effort, and who brought the the slate of alternate electors and the votes and all the documents to Johnson's office, or whether he brought them himself, you know, it's unknown.
Rich, we'll keep watching for coverage on this. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter. He talked to us about news from yesterday's congressional House hearing that Senator Ron Johnson's staff asked to pass a slate of false presidential electors to the vice president on January 6th, 2021. Now, earlier this month, an engineer at Google went public with concerns he raised about one of the company's language models starting to think it was alive. The company looked into his claims and dismissed them and ultimately placed him on administrative leave. Other computer science experts have reviewed the transcripts and agreed the model is not sentient, but it is leading the industry to have wider conversations about the morals and ethics of technology that might border someday on consciousness, as well as algorithms that affect our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about artificial intelligence? Have you heard about this story, about this Google engineer raising these concerns? What do you think? Where do you draw the line between a computer program and a living thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. John Basil is an associate professor of philosophy at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. He's the associate director in charge of AI and data ethics initiatives at the Northeastern University Ethics Institute. He earned his PhD at UW-Madison. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Let's start with this story. People may have seen it in the news. Initially, some people maybe got excited or worried. What do you make of this claim from this Google engineer?
Like most of Google and many other people, I think it pretty implausible that this particular technology is sentient, if we mean by that something like conscious or capable of feelings or understanding or having a sort of inner mental life. Maybe it's intelligent in some sense. That's a pretty broad term, but I think it pretty unlikely that it meets the bar for sentience.
Let's talk about a few terms here. Artificial intelligence, we go to a lot. I think it might mean different things to different people. How do you broad strokes define it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I don't think there's a single definition that's accepted. People use it in different ways, but broadly it means artificial systems that can engage in behavior that we recognize as intelligent in some sense. It can solve a problem in a way that we broadly see as intelligent or human. And that means lots of different things because there's lots of different kinds of intelligences that we recognize. Most of today's artificial intelligence comes in the form of machine learning, which is algorithms that are trained on lots and lots of data. And so they can accomplish really intelligent tasks on the basis of that training.
And a lot of these machine learning things do things that are meant to resemble creativity, art, or writing something, or in this Google engineer's case, having a conversation with a human. Can you talk about how that works if I'm sitting down and maybe having a typed conversation with this machine learning thing that talks a little like people?
Yeah, sure. So imagine that the way I train this algorithm is I just gave it tons and tons of text. So it's read Shakespeare and Jane Austen and science journals and what people have said on the internet, and it's learned when people say things like, hi, how are you doing? It should reply from some list of things like, oh, I'm good, how are you? Or something like that. And so if you train it on enough data, it can get pretty good at having a conversation with you. I mean, this kind of programming has been going on for a long time. There's a famous thing called the Turing test. Alan Turing sort of thought the way to understand intelligence was if you could have someone have a conversation with someone behind a screen and they couldn't tell whether it was a computer or a human, then that's the Turing test. That would count as intelligent. And we're getting closer and closer, or it seems, to things that can pass that kind of test where you could have a conversation with them and you might not be able to tell that you're talking to a machine. Now, most instances we can tell, you get on a chatbot online to get some help for some services you have, or some, you're going to cancel a service and you're talking to a chatbot and you can tell that it's not quite human. But we're getting further and further along, and Lambda seems to be like that.
Lambda is the Google product we're talking about here. Now, if we're trying to define artificial intelligence as having some kind of, I don't know, consciousness or self-awareness, it seems like part of the problem is we don't necessarily know how to define that for a biological creature like a human.
Yeah, we have a real difficult time saying exactly what it is. Like, we know what it is because it's happening to us all the time. And we also have a real hard time figuring out what the basis for it is. Like, what can a system made of silicon even have that kind of state? Like, this is a serious debate at the sort of foundations of philosophy and cognitive science about what grounds consciousness. Like, what exactly can give rise to this thing that we can barely describe?
We're talking to Northeastern University philosophy professor John Basil about the morals and ethics of artificial intelligence and algorithms that affect our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your hopes for artificial intelligence? Do you have questions? Do you have concerns about it? And how about these big data things that might affect a lot of decisions in our lives, like whether we get a mortgage, a job, a prison sentence? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with John Basil, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Northeastern University, with us today to talk about the prospect of sentient artificial intelligence and how it would fit into our moral and ethical systems. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question, a thought about artificial intelligence, what it is, do you have worries about what it could mean for us humans and about how we treat it if and when we have an artificial intelligence that we agree, yeah, is somehow equivalent to a form of consciousness? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. John, part of the reason, as I understand it, that this Google engineer brought up these concerns about Lambda is he was worried not about how an artificial intelligence will treat humans, but about how we treat it. What are the ethics? What are our responsibilities to something like this that we've created? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is the part, while I don't think that this system rose to the level of sentience, I do think we are ill-prepared for that possibility. We don't have the greatest track record of treating individuals of other species well. It took a long time, for example, to get oversight boards to govern animal subjects research to make sure animals weren't being harmed unnecessarily. And the real risk, I think, is given that we have a hard time saying what consciousness is and how it arises, there's a real risk that if we created a sentient AI, we might not be able to tell that we've done so. We might not be able to figure out what would be good or bad for it. We might be totally ignoring what would make its life go well or poorly, or make it suffer or benefit. Might just shut it off. And so I think that there, given the hype there is behind AI, there's a real risk that we don't have measures in place to ensure that we avoid unethical treatment if that thing were to arise. Now when will that arise? I don't know, but we're not well prepared for that circumstance.
Now, that's a hypothetical that we're not prepared for. Another issue I know you're concerned about is something that is here and happening now, the use of big data and algorithms to crunch through that data to figure out a lot of stuff that affects our lives. I mentioned a few moments ago that might include getting a mortgage or a job or determine a prison sentence in part. What kind of concerns do you have about the way those tools are used?
Oh man, we only have like 10 minutes, right? it's a serious problem for a number of reasons. There's concerns about fairness, that these algorithmic decision-making systems, they encode bias in the data. Our bias is data. Our data is biased. They learn that bias, but then they spit out what seem like objective measures. So we're not even sensitized often in to the ways that they're biased. There's also different kinds of privacy concerns that arise with these technologies than with typical technologies. On the basis of what seems like pretty mundane data, they can make really invasive inferences about us. So we have to rethink what privacy is and how to respect privacy in the face of these big data analytics tools. There's problems of transparency. We can't always understand exactly, not for reasons of like patents or copyrights, but we really can't figure out how these systems make the decisions they're making. So how do we figure out what's going on inside them? And does it matter when we can't? That's just three: transparency, privacy, and fairness. There are many more. One of the things I often say is that we just don't yet have an ethics ecosystem or an ethics infrastructure for managing these problems. We're trying to build them, but the technology is moving really fast.
Whose job is it to build that ethical ecosystem to make those qualities, the transparency and privacy, front and center?
Yeah, one of the challenges is that the answer is all of us. We need sensitive regulation, because that's going to motivate a lot of people to take this seriously. But as in all areas, regulation is just one piece of managing ethics. Like, compliance is sort of the floor for ethics. And then there's, what else can we do? We need companies to better understand the ethical problems. We need ethicists like me to understand the technologies better, so we don't just trot out old solutions that are really useful for technologies that we in the past, but they're not useful in this context. Like, privacy protections that we developed for traditional technologies or for medical records are not as useful in the context of big data analytics. So there's a distributed responsibility, which is another one of the problems, because it's much easier to churn out technologies that do very cool things, but also have really bad consequences, than it is to build this infrastructure.
Can you give us a for instance of how big data is being used and then plugged into algorithms, for better or worse, in ways that might affect us?
Yeah, I think the most famous example is probably the Compass recidivism prediction tool. This is a tool that is trained on lots of data and provides risk scores for people. It's been used for pretrial detention, so determining whether a given individual should be held without bail or held prior to trial, based on their risk score, based on past information that has been trained into the system. And so one of the things that people worry about, for good reason, is, do these systems disproportionately negatively impact Black arrestees? Do they get higher risk scores on average than white arrestees? And what does that mean for sort of issues of distributive and procedural fairness?
Talking to John Basil, associate professor of philosophy at Northeastern University, looking at the ethics surrounding artificial intelligence and things that might look like it, algorithms that use big data to make decisions that affect us. We had a caller call in, John, who wanted to reference 2001, A Space Odyssey, famously an artificial intelligence gone awry a little bit. Like, how much of our thinking about this is shaped and maybe sent in the wrong direction by all the science fiction that we've had leading up to today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think sometimes it's misleading, but sometimes it really paints a picture that can help us sort of better conceptualize the ethical challenges. Now, the thing about Space Odyssey is it's made very clear to us that this thing is a villain. It's not so clear that it's sentient or conscious, but we know it's the bad guy. But I think they really do. I mean, most of the cases where we have these sci-fi issues about sentient AI, they really do force us to think about the key question, like, is it really sentient? Like, my favorite example is WALL-E. There's a Pixar movie, because you really feel a lot of sympathy for WALL-E. But is WALL-E sentient? Is WALL-E sad that he can't be with Eva? I think that's the name of the other robot. Mm-hmm. So, like, they really raise these questions, what philosophers would call epistemological questions of how can we come to know that these things have an inner life, that they're conscious, that they're self-aware.
I want to talk about the garbage in, garbage out part of this. You mentioned how algorithms can reinforce our biases. Some of these machine learning things, as you mentioned, trawl the internet looking for examples for their reactions, their responses. There's a lot of horrible stuff on the internet. There's a lot of great stuff in the internet. There's a lot of fact and a lot of fiction on the internet. How do we make sure that our inputs, whether we're talking about an algorithm or a machine learning tool or a hypothetical sentient AI of the future, how do we control to make sure that the inputs it's getting are useful?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are lots of computer scientists working on how to solve this problem. There's a lot of work already done being able to identify the ways in which even when we try our best to keep the garbage out, it gets in. But I think one of the things we want to think about is the problem is not just about managing the data, because a lot of the data that's going to make for useful applications, we can't control. So we got to think of these things as a holistic process, that these are tools that they integrate into socio-technical decision-making systems. And we can also think about how to mitigate the bias at the other end by making sure we keep humans as part of the process, by making sure they understand the tools they're using, so they recognize the ways in which they're biased, so they can respond in a way that sort of mitigates against the bias. So it's not just about keeping the garbage out, because if we have to keep all the garbage out, then we lose out on a lot of the benefits of the algorithms. Although sometimes we might think, no, you can only use pristine data. The problem is that even when the data is, when we try to keep the data really pristine, we end up with the same kinds of problems.
Now, you're looking at these cutting edge questions. Again, some of these are hypotheticals that aren't even here yet. From the lens of philosophy and traditions that go back literally thousands of years, are you able to take what you look at in AI and bring it back and maybe talk to your students about the things they might be learning in their 101 classes and tie those together?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's never been easier to explain why some of the fundamental issues in philosophy matter for practical things, because the promises that people in the AI space make often just are point us directly back at these thousand-year-old questions. So there's a lot to learn from the current context about sort of fundamental ideas. Are they motivate thinking about these deeper issues? But also we face a fun challenge the other way. It's a difficult challenge, but it's fun. Is like the tools we developed for 2,000 years. How do we apply them to these tools? And like, how do the nuances of, for example, artificial intelligence and machine learning make us rethink or make us adapt the tools we've been developing for other contexts? So yeah, my classrooms are full of talking about the near future, the far future, and how it connects with the distant past, at least within philosophy.
And briefly, what are you most interested in that near future horizon?
Yeah, in the near future, I'm mostly thinking currently about issues of governance. How do we build structures? How do we bring the right people in the room to sort of solve these problems across the system? So how do we build that ethics ecosystem to really take on these problems?
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Basil is an associate professor of philosophy and associate director in charge of AI and data ethics initiatives at the Northeastern University Ethics Institute. He was with us today to discuss issues of morals and ethics around artificial intelligence and other cutting-edge computer technology. This after a Google engineer claimed that one of the tools that he works with had achieved some form of sentience. Google and most people in this line of work say probably not yet, but it raises a lot of interesting questions. Coming up after the news, a pediatrician explains what we need to know about the COVID vaccine for infants and kids under 5, hoping you'll join in with your questions and your decision-making process along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.